Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay.
I don't know what happened to the disclaimer.
Those of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary
with
a contribution of $250
recording
and the common law default at $150.
All right. Michael Edward here. Thank you for attending with us tonight. Hello there, Marcia and John and Daniel and Vlad and Ron and Nita, Jennifer, and so many others. We have a first-time caller from Chicago, Illinois. If you'd be so kind, may I have just your first name only, this phone number ending in 8434. Just a first name, please. Hello? Am I heard? I've unmuted everybody. Can I be heard?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what happened with the record. All right. Thank you kindly. I'm going to go back and mute. Anyways, if I could, if this will help me out, just a first name only for the party calling from Chicago, ending in the phone number ending in 8434. May I have just your first name only, please? Okay, it won't be. All right, In anticipation for PJ arriving, he said he's going to be a few minutes late. I'd like to go over some things with you, if I may. The United States citizen is a corporation. Congressional record, this is June 13, 1967. So we're talking just a little over 50 years ago. 1967, pages 15641 through 15646, quote, a citizen of the United States, end quote, is civilly dead and operating as a co-trustee and co-beneficiary of the private constructive trust known as the Sestake Trust of the United States Incorporated under the 14th Amendment, which upholds the debt of the United States of America and the United States Corporation in Section 4. Then we read in People v. De La Guerra, 40 California, 311, 342. This is post-Civil War, 1870. This is written in part, quote, it is evident that the United States citizens have not the political rights which are vested in citizens of the states. They are not constituents of any community in which is vested any sovereign power of government. Their position partakes of the character of subjects rather than of citizens. They are subject to the laws of the United States, but have no voice in its management. If they are allowed to make laws, the validity of these laws is derived from the sanction of a government in which they are not represented. Mere citizenship they may have, but the political rights of citizens they cannot enjoy. That's extremely powerful. The United States Code uses a term in a place in 8 U.S.C. section 1502 of the term American national, while maintaining no such status as a 14th Amendment naturalized citizen of the United States. In 8 United States Code, section 1502, it says, quote, certificate of nationality issued by Secretary of State for person not a naturalized citizen of the United States for use in proceedings of a foreign state. The Secretary of State is authorized to issue in his discretion and in accordance with rules and regulations prescribed by him a certificate of nationality for any person not a naturalized citizen of the United States who presents satisfactory evidence that he is an American national and that such certificate is needed for use in judicial or administrative proceedings in a foreign state. Such certificate shall be solely for the use in the case in which it was issued, and it shall be transmitted by the Secretary of State, though and through appropriate official channels, to the judicial or administrative officers of that foreign state in which it is used. Foreign state. In 19 Corpus Juris Secundum, section 883, it says, the United States government is a foreign corporation with respect to a state. In the United States Code 8, section 1101A21, the term national means a person owing permanent allegiance to a state, not the federal government. At section 22, the term national of the United States means either a citizen of the United States or B, a person who, though not a citizen of the United States, owes permanent allegiance to the United States. These are two very distinct statuses within the American system. The former is a freeman, and the latter is a voluntarily served slave subject to the jurisdiction of the creation of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. It is a federally created capacity that it owes allegiance to. So with that, let's look at some state citizen versus U.S. citizen court cases. in Gardenia versus the Board of Registers. Quote, there are two classes of citizens, citizens of the United States and of the state, and one may be a citizen of the former without being a citizen of the latter. This is a 1909 decision. Can you tell me why, please, ladies and gentlemen? With every single court case, regardless of what it is, whether it's a traffic ticket or a marijuana bust, whatever, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Why is it never brought up by the defense attorney to force the prosecuting attorney to establish the class of citizenship? I mean, there are so many cases that define it. In Murphy versus Ramsey, now this is post-Civil War, 1885, federal citizenship, municipal franchise, domiciled in the District of Columbia, and the political rights of federal citizens are franchises which they hold as privileges. So it talks about political rights are not really rights, they're privileges. And they are at the legislative discretion of Congress. Now think about that. United States versus Valentine, you've heard me talk about this before. The only absolute and qualified right of a United States citizen is residence within the territorial boundaries of the United States. So go back up here to Murphy versus Ramsey. It talks about you having federal citizens that are franchises, that have privileges. Therefore, and this is Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox, therefore the U.S. citizen, the citizen of the District of Columbia, residing in one of the states of the Union, they're classified as property and franchises of the federal government as an individual entity. It's all they're telling you right here in these different court cases that there are two classes of citizenship. One has rights from the creator of the universe. The other one has privileges from the Congress. In Wheeling Steel Corporation, Fox, therefore, the United States, oh, we already gave that one, excuse me. Hendricks versus Maryland, a citizen upon leaving the District of Columbia becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident and does not have common law right of a citizen of one of the several states. 1914, just 100 plus years ago. In Cruikshank, U.S. versus Cruikshank, there is in our political system a government of each of the several states and a government of the United States. Each is distinct from the other and has citizens of its own. In Maxwell versus Dow, the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States do not necessarily include all the rights protected by the First Eight Amendments to the federal Constitution against the powers of the federal government. Ex parte Frank Knowles, 5 California. This also can be affirmed in the definitions in Title 5 of the United States Code and Title 26 of the United States Code and Title 1 of the United States Code. Quote, it might be correctly said that there's no such thing as a citizen of the United States. A citizen of any one of the states of the Union is held to be and called a citizen of the United States, although technically and abstractly, there is no such thing, end quote. So what do we conclude from all this? A citizen, a U.S. citizen, is a piece of property. And if you read any of the old court cases prior to the Civil War, where slavery was the issue, the debate was always over property rights. Therefore, a U.S. citizen is a slave. The 14th Amendment defines what a U.S. citizen is, quote, Section 1. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction are called citizens of the United States. So this so-called 14th Amendment, what does it do? It criminally converts U.S. citizenship completely upside down from what the Founding Fathers intended. So with this, I hope that gives a great kickstart for PJ. He's here with us right now to share with us his thoughts. Go with you, PJ.
Thank you, Michael. Hey, Michael, are you a U.S. citizen or are you a U.S. subject?
It's one and the same.
One and the same, isn't it? So when we talk to people, we probably should tell them that, you know, they say they're a U.S. citizen. Ask,
are you talking, PJ? I can't hear a word.
Yep, I'm talking.
PJ, your phone is muted?
Nope, it's not muted. I'll hang up and call back again.
PJ, you might want to hang up and call back in. I don't know what happened to your connection. He just hung up, ladies and gentlemen. He'll be right back. PJ's question is really good. It's important. Let me go to a definition here in the United States Code. This is very, very, very important. Let me go here. Master Americans, American by birth, I think is what it is. Let's see what we got there. Oh, my computer just crashed too. Isn't that lovely? Hang on.
You see me now?
I saw you before. It was, hey, Brian, we'll get to you in just a sec.
First. Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah, but your phone just
muted. Yeah, it didn't show that it was muted, and I muted it and unmuted it and muted it and unmuted it, and it didn't seem to make any difference. But anyway, the question is, Michael, are you a U.S. citizen or are you a U.S. subject?
It's, well, stipulation, it's presumed to be one and the same.
Yes. So when we talk to people and they say, oh, I'm a U.S. citizen, just ask them, okay, you're a U.S. citizen. Are you a U.S. subject? And, you know, it makes them think, subject, U.S. subject. What do you mean by U.S. subject? Well, citizenship means subject. A U.S. citizen is one that is subject to the United States.
You're gone again.
Boy.
PJ, your phone.
Does that make a difference there? Testing 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
We're not hearing you, PJ.
Testing 1, 2, 3,
maybe
1, 2, 3.
Put another nickel in it. Nickel in the jukebox. All right, while PJ is trying to work that out, let me give you Black's Law Dictionary, the definition of United States citizen. This is in the 6th edition of Black's Law. It's also the results of two Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court decisions, Bidwell of 1901 and Hooven of 1945. First definition of United States citizen. It may be merely the name, or not United States citizen, the first definition of United States. It may be merely the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations. I want you to remember the Treaty of Peace, the Treaty of Paris, where King George III, representing his kingdom, and Ben Franklin, representing the new United States of America. King George III referred to his former colonists, his former enemy combatants, as his peer. Well, the king is a peer, is a sovereign, and therefore a peer to a king would be a sovereign. So definition number one could apply to you. Definition number two, it may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. Well, that would be all the federal citizens. That would be everyone who is completely subject to the Congress, and the Congress has sole jurisdiction over them. Or third, it may be the collective name of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. These would be state citizens. State citizens have their rights from the creator of the universe. Territorial citizens, number two, have their rights from the Congress. Territorial citizens have civil rights. State citizens enjoy natural rights. Is PJ back yet?
Yeah, can you hear me?
PJ, I see that you're talking because anytime somebody talks, a blue light appears over their name, a blue highlight appears. And,
yeah,
I can see that you're talking, but I cannot hear you.
I don't know. I got four bars, so must be on your end.
Now you're back.
Huh.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I got three or four bars here, and I've been talking on the phone all day, and nobody's said any problems with me. Just interrupt when you can't hear me anymore, because I can always hear you. Can you hear me now?
Clear.
You can hear me clear?
I can hear you clearly. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, when we talk to people and they say they're a U.S. citizen, just remind them that means you're subject to the United States written laws. And now, if you're not, if you come into America, the default jurisdiction is American common law, which is basically in America. Fortunately, it's biblical law, and you're subject to the jury of 12 potentially. So now the Constitution talks about the Bill of Rights, and it says that if you have a controversy that's greater than $20, which is in 1791, when the Bill of Rights was written, $20 was an ounce of gold. So the Bill of Rights tells us today that if your controversy is equivalent to an ounce of gold, which is, I don't know what it is today, $1,700 or something like that. Haven't looked for a long time. Then you have a right to a common law proceeding, and a jury trial. Now I don't understand exactly how in the world, if you lived in a society, how you can force a jury to convene for you. But hopefully you live in a society that's willing to do it. A lot of retired people, wise men would be wonderful people to have on the jury. So most societies could generate that. Now, I believe that if we have a controversy today over anything, that we have a right to take it to a common law jury. And the United States would have to come into that proceeding and prove that it had the authority to move it into an administrative court, that they'd have the right to move you into a administrative criminal court case for not paying taxes, for example, to the federal government, not filing a 1040. Now, I believe that if things were handled properly in America, that you could go into a common law proceeding, and they would have to prove that they have authority to pull you away from the general jurisdiction and subject you to a United States court, which would be a contractual relationship. So if the common law, if the jury of 12 could see that it was a valid contract, then they would say, yeah, you got to keep your contract and get over there to the administrative court, which would be wonderful, because in a lot of cases, Michael's arguments and challenges could come up and say, you know, what did I say, Duerstein, for me to lose my aggregate jurisdiction, which is land jurisdiction, which is by default in America a common law, and when did I waive that and have to show up in a United States court? Because a lot of those courts are absolute kangaroo courts. They're terrible. I don't know what they were like 100 years ago, but many of them are very. You just can't get it's a joke. It's a joke. I was visiting with an individual that we work with. He scored very high on the bar exam, and he took it just for fun. And he one year he got 97 tickets, I think. And Michael and I were talking to him, and he prevailed on every ticket except one. I think one he kind of felt that it wouldn't hurt him to pay a fine because he think he was being a little ridiculous or something. But, I mean, think about it, 97 tickets in one year. I mean, I assume that most of them were speeding because he raced motorcycles. So, and he would just go in and just argue, do I we're in this court. Is there evidence that I don't have a right to go from point A to point B with my motorcycle, whatever he was driving that day? So that is your main defenses to how to bring into the court a challenge to be subject to their court, because a lot of these cases they would not prevail if they were forced to bring in their evidence before a common law jury. Now, a common law jury, you can require that there's no U.S. citizens on the jury, because a U.S. citizen would be, if you're going against the United States, why would you want a United States citizen jury? Because that's the defendant, if you're the plaintiff. You know, why would you want one of their boys to be on the jury? That's not, he's got a contractual relationship with them. That's kind of, he's going to be partisan or partial. Is that the right word? Partial, prejudice, whatever. There's been individuals, there was one guy in California that went into court for a traffic case, and he required a common law proceeding and put his argument forth and the historical evidence that he has a right to it. And the judge says, yeah, that'll be fine. And then the prosecutor stood up and said, Your Honor, you need to understand that no U.S. citizens can be on the jury. And then the judge says, Counsel, let's meet in my chambers. And they came out about 10 minutes later and dismissed the case, because they did not want anybody in the community to realize that this man had a right to a common law proceeding with no foxes watching the hen house. They didn't want that. Because if they did provide him with a common law jury, he thought, and then they stacked the jury with U.S. citizens, and he's up against the state or the county or the city or some municipality, how is he going to overcome, how's he going to get a fair trial with that jury, because they are all heavily contractually related with the opposing party. Now, as far go ahead.
Opposing counsel went into chambers with a judge. Did the defendant go in with them as well?
No.
Well, that can't happen.
Well, either way, it worked out for him.
Well, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. That was Richard McDonald. You've probably heard of him out of California.
Sure.
He was a good researcher. I'm not a big advocate of a bunch of case law, but that case law does help you understand why you how to formulate your defenses and how to keep why it's so important to keep the burden of proof on them. Because even in their case laws, they argue that, like Michael just read tonight, you know, one judge says there's no such thing as a United States citizen. And then the other guy says, the other judge says absolute limitations of a United States citizen or something like that. So they don't even agree. But the beauty of America is that the burden of proof is on the moving party, not on, and you don't have to convince it. You don't have to produce the evidence for the judge. The judge is not allowed to produce the evidence, even though they do a lot of times, and a lot of people don't know how to object to that. It's upon the moving party. They've got to put it on the record, and then you get an opportunity to cross examine whatever evidence they bring forward, if it's document or witness. One time a judge, a friend of mine was in court, and I can't remember what the issue was, but the judge started making comments, and the guy asked the judge to take his robe off and swear himself in and sit in the witness chair. And the judge says, oh, okay, I know what you're getting at. He says, I won't do that anymore. So he stopped the judge from testifying and adding for the opposing party, aiding the opposing party. And then when the attorney does the same thing, you can start doing that. Anytime an attorney makes a statement that has not been placed into evidence, that is detrimental to you. You know, objection, asserting facts, not in evidence. And then no attorney. Yeah, you ask the judge, is an attorney allowed to testify in this courtroom? And, of course, they're not, especially if you object. So what we got here is, let's just start out with a real common problem in America. Let's just go property taxes. No, we're on drivers. Driving your car. If you're driving a car on a road and you get stopped, that officer has to, is going to start gaining evidence that he can use in court. And I have a friend that's never lost a case, and he always identifies himself. He gives his full name and his birthday and a mailing location without the United States, he'll say. And never use a zip code. And then he takes the Fifth Amendment. So he doesn't give the officer and he says, you better not do it. He says, don't give the officer any registration. Don't give him any insurance card. And especially don't give him any driver's license. Even if you have a driver's license, don't hand it to him. Because if you hand him a driver's license, you're telling him, hey, this is what I'm using. I'm using this state permission right here. Here's the proof of my state permission. So anyway, when they go to court, he's in a good position to object to everything they put on the record, because they'll start putting his driver's license on the record and he'll object. They might they'll start putting the registration documents or the DMV records on the record. He'll object. And it puts them in a real bind. Go ahead, Michael.
What grounds is he objecting? On what grounds?
Asserting facts, not in evidence. And then they'll bring a witness in, and then they'll start testifying to, that he has a driver's license. If he has a driver's license, big deal. He might have a fishing license. He might have a deer hunting license. Big deal. He wasn't using them on that particular evening. And then he'll present the challenge to the court that, does he have a right, a God-given right, to, use that automobile and that open way, which we oftentimes call a highway. And, they're called highways so they can get up high when it rains. They're not down in the water. That's how the word started. And then the judge realizes that, this is going to be a problem. I got to get rid of this case as quick as I can. An individual, he was fishing. And here's an example. He was fishing, and the state parks people showed up and gave him a ticket. And he just goes to court, and he asks the judge, he says, Your Honor, where in the Constitution does it – forbid me to feed myself and my family by fishing? And, you know, you have a right. You have a right. In the Bible, it talks about when you're traveling, you can actually walk into a field. You can't walk in and destroy the field, but you can walk into the field and get a handful of grain and sustain yourself for your trip. It's not a violation of God's law. But you can't go out there and fill 50-pound bags. But God gave a provision for that. Now, when Moses traveled, 2-3 million people, and they could wipe out a field pretty fast. But Moses understood that, and he would actually pay people. He would ask them, we'll pay you for the provisions we need. We'll even pay you to cross your land at some points. God gives us a right to travel on his land. It's his land. Everybody else is just getting to use it in some degree. Now, if we move this into property taxes, you simply go into court and say, where in the Constitution does it clearly does it state that I do not have a right to own that land? Because if you own it, how can they tax it? Now, if they own it, they can tax it. And if you study their statutes, it actually alludes to them owning it, and that's why they can tax it. But they hide it up. So, you put the burden of proof on them to produce evidence before the judge and before you and in the court record what they rely upon that they have taxing authority for you to occupy that particular piece of land. You're occupying a piece of land, you're residing on it or whatever they might say, and they claim a right to tax you. So keep the burden of proof on them. And then you move it up a little bit to state taxes. We go into court and we put the burden of proof on them. You know, what did I say, do or sign for me to be subject to the state written law on state tax, property tax, or state income tax? And then you move it up another bump to federal taxes, the same thing. You just present your affirmative defense that as a man that's afforded the Bill of Rights, what does the moving party rely upon that my activity, a given activity at a given location by me is to be has a duty to be documented on a 1040 tax form and a tax paid. Keep the burden of proof on them completely. Because there's going to be rare times when they are going to produce evidence that you have to have a license to use a car at a specific location for a specific activity. And there's going to be times when you'll have to pay some state tax, and there's going to be times when you have to pay some federal tax. But it's going to be extremely rare. I think if you put money in a bank account, you make interest on it, you're subject to that tax. If you're traveling a road that is owned by the government and you're traveling for commercial purposes, you have to. There's going to be a fee involved, a tax, a requirement. So, but anyway, you don't have to speculate of what that could be. And before you go into a jurisdiction, some people write the governor of the state a letter requesting if they have a requirement to have a license, registration, or insurance to pass through a specific piece of land on a specific highway in a non-commercial capacity. And you carry that document with you, and if the officer pulls you over, you can show it to him. Hey, I sent this to the Missouri governor. Here's a certified letter of it. Here's a notary that swears that they aided in mailing it. And here's the tracking number that they delivered it. You can check it on the Internet. And here's a picture of the green card where the governor's clerk signed for it. And that's a lot of prima facie evidence that I requested factual evidence from them that I'm required to do a specific act, like have a license or a registration or insurance and so forth. Then you can do that with all. We do that with federal taxes. We do that with state taxes. We do that with driver's license. We do that with in some situations, we've done it with parking situations. A lot of times, I remember living in a city where I'd go down there, and there'd only be one car parked on a whole block, and they'd be out there writing tickets on that car. And so I'd go into court, they'd give me a ticket, I'd go into court, and I'd say, Your Honor, I got this parking ticket. They stuck it on my windshield, and I need evidence from you guys that you own that land. And then, boy, they dismissed the parking ticket just like that. And I'd walk outside and some people would talk to me. That's not right. You know, you don't have to pay parking tickets, but everybody else has to. And I said, you got to understand that I'm parking on a street that nobody's even using and they're writing me a parking ticket. I can understand if there's hardly any places to park and they want people to move occasionally so that businesses can have a turnaround and things like that. But, they were being abusive to me. That's why I'm here in court. So, because when I'm on a busy street and there's a meter, I pay it. Because I understand that they want the turnaround. They don't want people to park there and leave their car there for 3 days, and the restaurant has no place for people to park and eat. So, Michael, any questions out there?
Yes, we have Brian here in Texas that's raised his hand. In fact, he had it raised off immediately. Go ahead, Brian.
Michael, can you hear me?
I hear you well. Thank you, sir.
Oh, great. Thank you. The reason I was trying to speak up earlier is because I think the rest of us could hear PJ. I think you were just losing him, but that might be a problem on your side. Not sure. My question to PJ is, you know, I try to keep my thumb on the heartbeat of the cryptocurrency industry, looking at it globally. You know, I'm seeing a lot of things come down the pipe, you know, potentially repercussions, reverberations, but associations with some very detrimental things. And the only thing I see that they could apply is asset forfeiture. Maybe if you are cryptocurrency mining, or maybe if you are associated with the exchange for some reason. I'm just seeing things in other countries, and I'm trying to equate it over here. But so my question is to you, I mean, how have you dealt with asset forfeiture? And, you know, if
I've had discussions with people that have had, you know, all federal written law is land limited. And the oftentimes the only nexus they get to you through land jurisdiction is that all U.S. citizens have a special residence in the District of Columbia. And their address is actually the residential address. The primary residential address is perpetually like 1100 or 1200 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C.
That's called a domicile. That's referred to as their domicile.
Yeah, and that's their nexus for land jurisdiction to be able to apply the United States written laws to them. So forfeiture is a United States written law, so they have to produce evidence of a nexus. Now, I don't see how they can have a nexus if you're not one of their franchisees, their U.S. citizens, U.S. subjects. You're not operating under one of their licenses. And let's just say you're not on their land. You know, what nexus are they relying upon? You took possession of some negotiable instruments. You know, how can they claim, how do they claim right to that negotiable instrument? Instrument is yours. Go ahead.
I completely agree with you, but they seem to subvert the entire process with a guilty until proven innocent, so therefore you've got to wait until your time in court, regardless of the situation.
Well, that might be true for the average person, but if you ever get in trouble like that, contact us, and we'll put a brief under the main judge in that jurisdiction and the arresting the head of that department, and it's very likely you'll have your money back within 48 hours. Because they have to, they're going to realize that they're dealing with somebody that has put the burden of proof on them to prove that they have a right to take that property from you. Now, a negotiable instrument, if you own a negotiable instrument, you know, they used to say you can't burn it. And, you know, if you're found burning it, you can be arrested. And that might be true if you're standing on government land, but I don't see how in the world you can have that can be your property and you can burn it. Now, if you're standing on your property and you're duplicating it and trying to pass it to somebody as a as an original dollar bill, for example, $20 bill, $100 bill, yeah, I can see how people would say, hey, 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 those things are used in society for a specific standard of you know, limited amount of them in circulation stuff. You can't do that. But anyway, as far as having $1 million in cash with you and or burning it, I don't even know how in the world they get their jurisdiction to do that. Now, every time you go into court on one of those things, they'll say that you're a resident of a certain county, city and county and state, and then they'll also say that you're violating one of the state laws or the laws of the United States, and that you are in a state or a county, and all those things are there to evidence a nexus for the judge to have prima facie evidence of jurisdiction, authority to administrate the case. So you have to be prepared to put a challenge to every one of those. If they say you're in the county, you got to put a challenge in there to produce the evidence that you were in the county or the state or the city or the municipality or the parish or whatever. They got different names for different jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they have to prove all that. Now, here's an example. I had an individual that graduated from law school out of Michigan, taught with his class, and he refused to get the bar exam, just like some of my other friends. And he in Texas, they had a, I think it was a Mormon group of about 250 people. I can't remember if it was 250 families or 250 people, but the state claimed they had authority to go in there and take the children away because of some reports of child abuse. So they went in there and they took 250 children about from these parents, and they contacted this guy and they asked him what can we do about it. So they he told them to get a sworn statement together from each parent and have them swear to if the children have or have not a social security number and have or have not a birth certificate. And all but one child was released within 24 hours after they handed those affidavits in. Now, that would have been a month or two, at least a month before they would have got those children back, probably without that affidavit. But the government bugged out of there as soon as they were given notice in that format to the affidavit. Because they were basically removing the prima facie evidence of the administrative authority of the United States or the state, which is the same jurisdiction. And we need to do the same thing on everything. Anytime they walk up and say, just this month they claim they've taken two houses from me for property taxes. So I'm going to go into court and say, hey, 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 you guys, which is why they're really getting desperate. They didn't even notice me about the proceedings. They just changed the title to the homes. They claim they're going to have a right to do that. So this will be quite interesting. So any more question? It was a good question.
No, that was eloquent. I mean, you just indicated every action by the government deserves a equal and opposite in order to make them sit up and listen. So, now that was
great. Yeah, Michael, do you remember, Michael, who was the guy that says that the most important duty of a citizen is to challenge authority, I think. Was it Benjamin Franklin or somebody? I didn't mean to cut you off. What were you going to say?
Oh, no. That was good. I was going to take something you said on the phone thing and burning the phone and burning the information, but if that was, like, say, federal authority and they bought the phone for you or whatever, then you would run into potential repercussions because you consented to owning that phone that was provided by them. But then, you know, I think to my technical constructs, and it's always bring your own device now everywhere they want to go because they want to save money, they want to use your device. So they take over your device based on you consenting for you to use it. So that's a sticky area, too. I just wanted to sidetrack on something you said earlier that was intriguing to me.
Yeah, you got to be careful when you get a grant or something from the state or the federal government. It has strings attached to it. Okay, Michael, anybody else out there with a question?
All right, well, let's check. Freedom's Radio first. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question for PJ. While you're thinking about pressing the button, press star 2. I'm going to check Freedom's Radio to see if there are any questions over there. Julia, thank you for your comment. I rebooted my phone and everything's fine. Anybody else? Press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to have a call shorter than I'd like to. All right, Daniel. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. You know, I don't know if this is even any apropos or not, but I'm in a situation right now, and I want to know did you know anything about reverse mortgage?
Yes, we do. They have a lot of requirements in those things, and we will investigate it from the beginning to the end, and in most of the cases, if not all of the cases, we've found enough errors and mischief behavior, bank fraud, double dipping. I don't know. Michael can probably think of a few other names too. That justifies biblically for us to go in and give them notice that we're not going to pay until they prove up that you're that they have a standing to collect payment from you. We never say that, you know, you guys don't have standing to collect payment from us. We always ask the question. Anytime you're with an individual, you always ask questions. You never tell them. A bank or the state or the federal government or the court, and even the appeals court, you always want to ask them. We ask that the court would investigate if I, as a man, have a right to travel on that given road, and as associated with that, with the case, and just be polite to them. Just ask them. It shifts the burden of proof to them. So it's a very smart way to do it. And they're not accustomed to that. They're accustomed people and they send these appeals in, these documents in, and I don't have to do this. It's not American. It's not constitutional. And they just get sick and tired of hearing that. But when you write it and just simply ask them in a kind way a question, they feel motivated to answer it. But, you'll have to get with Michael. If you have a sizable reverse mortgage that's given you some problems and, you sense that there's some hanky panky going on, we might got to work out a program to bring the bank to accountability. Am I putting that together a fair enough statement, Michael?
Hey, you know, I have something. Like my parents, we've been in this home for about 72 years, and my mother just passed away about 2 months ago. Any time reverse, I don't know. See, that's why I don't know the rules. After you pass away, how soon before they, you know, could take over the, either I give you a chance to pay for the home or abandon it. And I was raised in a really nice place and area, and I'm just wondering if I have any rights.
How much is outstanding on the reverse mortgage?
It's about almost $400,000. Dollars. Outstanding.
Yeah, that'd be worth our time to do an investigation on it. So you'll have to meet with Michael, and we'll work out a program. But we are very busy with those things, and we are very successful with them. But we don't take very many of them on because of just don't have time. But give all the facts to Michael, and we'll examine it, and I'll get back to you.
Yes. If this RV come through, I wouldn't have to worry about it, but it would have to come through like this week, you know. So and I've been holding my breath, but anyway, just hoping a prayer. Hey, but thank you very much. I'm gonna get back with Michael, and then we're gonna work. I'm gonna work out something. Okay. I thank you very much. Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Michael.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else? Last call for the opportunity. One more time. Press star 2 on your keypad. Let me check Freedom's Radio. And otherwise, if nobody does, we'll call it a night. Well, thank you all for joining us this week. Thank you, PJ. Sorry for the technical problems on my end earlier. Until then, until next week, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.